You're listening to Art Snap, a podcast giving you a quick skim of famous works of art.
Hey, this is Claire.
And this is Zach.
Hey, Zach, how are you?
Hey, Claire, I'm doing well. But, well, I got a feeling that you may not like me very much after today. I've got a feeling that today's topic is going to be a little bit controversial and probably not for the reasons you're thinking.
Oh, no. You picked an artist I don't like, didn't you?
I mean, I just know that people are generally split down the middle on this artist, and you either love his work or you feel like it's too simple and therefore kind of underwhelming. I think
okay.
You probably even know who this is.
All right. But for the record, I'm not against minimalism. Okay. But I think I know who you're about to say.
I think you know who it is too. Who do you think it is?
I think you're about to like tell me how freaking amazing Mark Rothko is and how he
yes.
brings you to your knees to the very yep. verge of, you know, your deepest emotions, aren't you?
And genius. You left out genius. yep. So for this week's episode, I've chosen, wait for it, a piece called Untitled.
Oh, amazing. Hooray. We can talk about the color fields. Great. Well, of course, I think they're all untitled, aren't they?
I know, but with good reason. I'm going to tell you more about that later, but yeah,
all
we'll
right,
get there.
So you could have just picked any of his works because, you know, they all look alike.
See, this is what I'm talking about. This is the Rothko naysayers that,
No, to be fair, I like Rothko in that I've like dug in really hard and challenged myself to try so hard to like Rothko because it's kind of like one of those artists that it seems like all the cool art people like. So I'm like, oh, I just want to be there with everybody.
Listen,
but
you're...
you know, I'm just torn. Because I don't really get it. And I'm kind of apathetic about it.
You're not alone. And in fact, recently I was flying to Montreal to see the new Marisol retrospective exhibition at the Museum of Fine Arts there. And I sat next to this lovely woman from DC, and I mentioned that I had gotten to see the new exhibition of Rothko's works at the National Gallery. And she mentioned, oh yeah, I'd love to see that also. But then she quickly followed up with, I mean, I do kind of like him, but it just looks like something I could do or a 5-year-old could paint. And I mean, this is a pretty common response you get from a lot of people whenever you mention Rothko's name.
Yeah.
And so
you were like a missionary for Rothko on that flight, weren't you?
I mean, I did my best and I convinced her to at least go see the exhibition, which I think was great. But yeah, but I get it. I mean, I really do. And Rothko even heard a lot of this from art critics throughout his early years. And perhaps, you know, part of my connection is sentimental too. So, you know, there's lots of reasons we love Rothko or don't.
Well, let's get into it. Why don't you describe our piece we're looking at for the listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had a tough time choosing which piece because, and now you're going to laugh at me, but I love so many of them.
Of course you do.
but this untitled work from 1961 is huge. It's 8'4" by 7'6". There's a background field of maroon or a kind of really dark but rich purple. It's a color with a lot of depth. And then there's this kind of green rectangular form that almost kind of floats on top of that deep maroon background.
Yeah. And I guess if you like really study it, there's like a small dark hole kind of off to the left side, almost like another window.
Yeah, there's all this kind of depth of color and these kind of dark and light spots. But, you know, with so much depth of color across the piece, it's hard to tell which part is the same depth. Does one part stand out further than another? Is it looking through a window or is it the form kind of floating on top of the abyss? It's part of the mystery and the emotional experience I think he was trying to afford the viewer here too.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you have a sentimental feeling about Rothko. So like, what is your connect? Well, like, what do you feel when you connect with this?
Yeah, great question. So, I mean, I first learned about Rothko in college in my freshman year from my philosophy teacher. You know, she was an incredible woman who became a mentor of mine eventually.
So, yeah, you studied Rothko in philosophy?
Well, not exactly. My parents lived overseas at the time, you might remember, and my professor Linda and her husband Bob would invite me over for hot meals and good conversation. I mean, her house was like an art museum, and so as a young kid, like, I learned so much from her in those years.
Oh, that's really awesome she was there for you like that. It's like every college freshman's dream.
Right. Especially if you're coming from overseas and trying to assimilate. But, you know, I remember the first time I walked into their home, and right off the main entrance was this kind of formal dining room, and she had this huge reproduction Rothko print. I mean, I was just mesmerized by it. It sort of sucked me in. And I had missed Rothko in my art education classes while growing up overseas, and I had never seen something like that.
Yeah, right. You grew up in Africa, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. But Linda would talk about Rothko being one of her favorite artists and how his expression of the range of human emotions was something meaningful to her. And fast forward many years later, I really hadn't even thought about Rothko again until I got to see my first painting of his in person. You know, it was like looking into a portal. I was immediately sucked in.
Well, where did you see it? Where was it?
I think it had to be at the Met in New York. It's like you could feel the painting, you know, every brush stroke, every aspect of the color, something about the tones and the depth that left me feeling like I was actually looking into a window. And not to get too esoteric, Claire, but, you know, even a window into the feeling itself. It could be like a warm hug or an isolating melancholy, depending on how you respond to the piece and the colors and the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to take that. I'm not going to say that art is like emotionless, and certainly nobody is going to have the same thing when they stand in front of a piece of art, certainly. But I don't know. I feel like, you know, whatever emotion you brought to that painting as a viewer is what you're going to get from it. In other words, like, I could break down crying when I watch, you know, a Tide commercial or read a Garfield cartoon if like that's where I'm at that moment, right? Yeah, so I guess I am being like the yin to your yang here and kind of like teasing you about it, but like, aren't you giving like these color planes a bit too much power?
Well, listen, that was Rothko's entire ethos. It was about expressing the essence of universal human drama. I mean, he even described his paintings as dramas. The painting becomes the tragedy and the ecstasy of kind of our emotional selves. That was part of it.
Well, I mean, it sounds like he has this like defined experience he wants people to get out of the paintings. I remember I saw a Rothko at the Tate in London. And again, it was like, you know, okay, great. I feel like I was one of those viewers that's like, okay, I just want to see a Rothko, right? Like, had I not known it was this big deal, I probably wouldn't have paused that much. Again, it was a minimalist painting, and there are minimalist artists out there that I do get excited about. For one, Eve Klein, who was even more minimalist than Rothko. He would do entire canvases just in like a flat, like indigo, the richest blue out there. And yeah. I get excited about that because I feel like I've already, or all my whole life, had like an emotional, exciting connection to blue. I was that kid that like wanted their blue rain boots on and drank my milk from my blue cup and blue, 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 blue. And so I'm like, oh, Eve Klein, you know, that's awesome. And he was obsessed with it. Like, oh, let's put the canvas on top of my car and drive and see what it does to the blue. Now let me have a bunch of naked ladies roll around in this blue paint. You know, so I can get it. I can get excited about like the minimalist color even. But yeah, I'm just kind of like, okay, Rothko, yay. Like maybe I didn't get my like cool art appreciator card.
Well, but you know, yeah. Simple can still have depth of meaning. And then we think about how simple is the color really, because his technique was very defined. And so he had a way of kind of diluting or thinning out the paint and the pigment so much that it kind of became this very kind of thin layer. And he would just build and build and build on layers of that. And it kind of, the result is this sense of transparency and luminance. Like you're looking at the piece and you're not sure even where your eyes should stop. Does it stop at the canvas? Does it keep going? Does it keep going? Even the darkest ones have this sense of radiance. But yeah, for him, color wasn't even the point. It was just kind of the tool to kind of express what he wanted the viewer to experience.
Yeah, no, and I get that, like, if you took two different colors and painted them on top of each other, you would not get that, like you were saying, the depth. He's got so many layers and textures that I don't think a lot of people that don't paint can appreciate. But like you mentioned earlier, I do remember reading at some point that he wanted to have like the viewers to have a conversation with the painting.
Yeah. And also he called it a communion, right? And so I don't want to take up too much of your time reading quotes because, you know, I could do that all day. But there's this one that's really poignant. And I want to read this excerpt to you because it's really fascinating. But in an interview, he at one point said, you might as well get one thing straight. I'm not interested in the relationship of color to form or anything else. I'm interested only in expressing basic human emotions, tragedy, ecstasy, doom, and so on. And the fact that a lot of people break down and cry when confronted with my pictures show that I can communicate those basic human emotions. The people who weep before my pictures are having the same religious experience that I had when I painted them. And if you are, as you say, moved only by their color relationship, then you're missing the point. I mean, that's a pretty powerful kind of statement about how he viewed his own works, but also not wanting to, detract from your own experience looking at them.
Yeah, you mentioned you just went and saw the current exhibition at the National Gallery of Art, and it was highlighting his works on paper. So what did you learn from that one?
Yeah, this is an area that gets less attention than his larger oil on canvas works, for which I think we all think of him and he's most known. But, you know, those dominate the final kind of decade or two of his life. But these works on paper tell a big part of the Rothko story. And I was already a fan, but it kind of gave me another piece of that puzzle that I just didn't have.
So what was the Rothko story? I know he's born in Russia.
Yep. Mark Rothko was born Marcus Rothkovich in a Jewish community in 1903 in Russia, which is now part of Latvia. But, you know, at the age of 7, he and his family picked up and immigrated to none other than Portland, Oregon.
Wow. That's a random place for a Russian immigrant in the early 1900s, right?
Well, it was. But, you know, his uncles had already moved there. There was actually a lot of opportunity in that part of the country in the Pacific Northwest. It was relatively close to Russia. But then as an adventurous 20-year-old after college, he moves to New York. He stumbles across painting and says, oh my gosh, this is the thing that I need to be doing with my life. He says, this is going to become my life. So he eventually takes a still life class with Max Weber, another Russian Jewish immigrant. And this is where you can start to see his early influence, because Weber taught so much about the emotional power of art and the inner spiritual vision that artists translate into color and form. You know, he soon connects with other artists like Cezanne and Matisse and those circles. And he starts out with a show in Portland and then later in New York. And eventually, you're going to love this, he meets in 1943 our friends Peggy Guggenheim and Max Ernst, which is kind of cool.
Oh, cool. Like throwback characters from episode one.
Yep. And so Peggy invites him to host a one-man show at her gallery. All the while, he's starting to make shifts in his work. It's evolving. And over the course of his painting life, you know, he really does move from realism to surrealism to these abstract forms, and eventually kind of leaving landscapes and figural painting completely behind.
So how does that influence the forms that we all know of today? Like, when did that begin?
Yeah, you know, I think he was in his 40s. And I mean, I think about being in my 40s now and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know, I better get going. But in his 40s, he starts to develop this new form that looks more like those transcendental kind of color field works. And, you know, he even called them organisms, that they take on their own life that gets revealed when the painting is finished. And here's when he ditches not only the titles of these pieces, but also he ditches frames. Like, he stops using frames. He stops using descriptions. You know, he really was trying to let silence be the delivery. And he said that adding words paralyzed the viewer's mind. He didn't want anything to kind of get between them.
Well, I remember him saying that, you know, nothing should be in between the viewer and my painting.
Right. That's exactly right. So, you know, frames, descriptions, titles, everything.
So this is something I've seen too often. We have even talked about it on the show. An artist gets to be super famous for like one specific thing, even if it doesn't represent like the entire body of their work or tell their whole story.
That's true. Although you could say that for many famous works of art, you know, they're the culmination of this decades of learning and experimentation by the artist. And I think that's definitely true for Rothko. I mean, he was a prolific experimenter and he took great liberty trying different colors and brush styles, sizes, and mediums to really express himself. And that's where I think the idea of the whole breadth of human emotion comes into play, because you see all different periods and styles through that. But, you know, there was this period in the final years of his life, for example, after he was ill for many years, that, you know, he got pretty dark. Very dark.
He eventually committed suicide.
Yeah, it's true. And in later years, his mood turned darker, more depressive, more lonely, more frustrated. You know, I don't know this, but I would imagine his increasing fame was hard to handle. At one point, he had kind of selected this very small group of people that he would even allow to buy his pieces. He wanted people to buy his paintings because they connected to them, not because they were popular or because they were about status. So as his mood darkened, so did his works. The livelier colors turned to browns and grays and blacks.
He didn't just want people buying them up. He needed people to have that connection or connect to mm-hmm. them. Yeah, I've also read that he denies that the later works were dark because of his moods, even though it's like really hard mm-hmm. not to like draw that conclusion.
Especially when you contrast it with those brighter earlier works that are almost ethereal. You know, there's the tangerines, the blues, the greens, the reds, the different colors, and they're so incredibly airy and wispy, contrasted with these kind of heavy and brooding pieces that they have so much depth to them too.
So where can we go to see this one that you spoke of in person?
Well, so this one lives at the Reina Sofia Museum in Madrid, Spain, but there are Rothko pieces all over the world. And the Phillips Collection in Washington, D.C. has the Rothko Room. There's even a monumental retrospective happening right now until April at the Louis Vuitton Foundation in Paris. But a quick online search will show you many other museums with works probably close to you.
Well, yeah, it'd be cool to see that one in person. I mean, his works got so big, right?
They did. And also in size, too. They actually grew in size as his career progressed. So many of them are quite large. But you've got to see one in person. In fact, he was so dedicated to the way that exhibitions were curated, with the lighting, with the sizing, with the spacing. He even said that really just to experience the painting, to feel it the right way, he said you should stand 45 centimeters from the piece, which is about a foot and a half, to really experience the movement of the piece without the borders kind of clouding you. So he really wants you to jump in. So point is, you got to see it in person to really experience it. And we'll let our listeners decide for themselves. Does it move them? Does it bring mm-hmm. them to tears? Does it kind of create apathy and, oh, well, that's interesting, or a five-year-old could do it? I'd love to kind of hear what people think. Mm-hmm. So
I'm going to do a Rothko-style painting, Zach, and I'm going to see if I can hold it up and have you break down.
Let's give it a whirl.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, you brought Untitled for us to all ponder today. And I will not rule out, you know, I will revisit my Rothko position and see it through your eyes.
Well, thanks so much, Claire. Great seeing you today.
Good to see you too.
Till next time.
All right, bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the work of art and the artist, check us out on Instagram, artsnap.pod.
If you liked hanging out today and talking about art, rate us and subscribe wherever you download your podcasts.
See you next time.